I'm Gary Nall. This is a special edition of our program on the deep state. We are looking today at our failing domestic economy, globalization, and how there is an effort underway to create a global police state. Who benefits? Who's behind it? What are their motives? Why is the media not covering any of this? How can this impact us? Does this also involve controlling the internet? And what about net neutrality? We're going to explore all this today with Professor William Robinson. Professor Robinson is professor of sociology at the University of California at Santa Barbara, and he describes himself as a scholar activist. He is also on the university's faculty of Latin American Studies and in the Global and International Studies program, and he is deeply involved in the American domestic and third world struggles for social justice, popular empowerment of populations, and participatory democracy and government. His areas of focus include globalization, transnationalism, political economics, immigration, and a variety of sociological issues. He received his graduate degrees from the University of New Mexico, and he's published 8 books, his latest being Global Capitalism and the Crisis of Humanity, which takes a hard look at the totalitarian structures and agendas of the transnational capitalist class that promotes neoliberal restructuring, and trade liberalization. His website is soc.usc.edu/faculty-robinson. Nice to have you with us today, Professor Robinson.
It's a pleasure to be on.
In order to fully understand people, the institutions, the think tanks, the foundations, the so-called unlimited number of experts that always seem to be appearing on television, on radio, and print media, defining what is real, defining what is important, defining what is true. And rarely do I ever hear or see a true progressive being invited on CNN, or being interviewed by the New York Times or the Washington Post or even the Los Angeles Times. Instead, I keep hearing people who justify our interventions around the world, who justify such things as asset forfeiture, globalization of our police, why we have a right to intervene in Syria and Iraq and Afghanistan and Iran and Honduras and other countries around the world, in the name of bringing democracy, freedom to these countries, without ever once seeing the irony of looking back, what did we bring to Vietnam, to Laos, to Cambodia, and other countries? For example, look at Libya. No one has taken responsibility for what that country has become today. And yet this is not new. This did not start with the Bush administration or the Clinton administration or Obama, but it has been in place for a long time. So would you begin, please? Take your time. There is no rushing this. And lay out for us the overarching view to explain what is the global police state. How does it function? How does it impact people around the world? How does it impact Americans? What do we need to know about it in order to change it? The forum is yours.
Yes. Well, I've been doing a lot of thinking about two different things. One is this concept of global police state, which encompasses some of the things you were just discussing, U.S. interventionism and warfare around the world, the control of our perception of what's going on in the world through the corporate media and the government itself and so forth. So on the one hand, I come up with this idea of a global police state. But on the other hand, I've been doing a lot of examination into the digitalization, the general digitalization of the global economy. This is a fundamental restructuring of capitalism worldwide through digitalization. Of course, it's been going on for several decades, but at this time, it is accelerating. And I came to the conclusion through this research between last year and this, what's in the first half of this year, that these two things are coming together. that digitalization and everything it implies, which I will refer to shortly, and global police state are now merging in the end of the second decade of the 21st century. And you mentioned at the beginning of the introduction the failing U.S. economy, and that's absolutely right. But the failing U.S. economy, of course, is part of the deeper story of the failing global economy. And we are absolutely due for a recession. They come about once every 10 years, and it's been 10 years since the last big economic crisis. But more than that, we are heading towards a looming economic crisis, which is going to be much bigger than just a recession. And in the context of all of that, the system is really facing a crisis of legitimacy, a crisis of hegemony. So I'm going to come back in just a moment and talk about this looming economic crisis, because it ties a lot of things together. But here I want to say that what I mean by global police state is that global capitalism facing this crisis needs such a police state for two reasons. One, for social control and repression to contain a lid on things. But secondly, it needs it simply in order to make profit, to accumulate capital in the face of looming crisis and in the face of stagnation. So I define global police state as three interrelated developments in the past few years. One is that there are these ever more omnipresent systems of mass social control, mass repression, and warfare, you referred to some of that internationally, being promoted by the ruling groups to contain what is either the real rebellion or at least a potential rebellion of the masses of the global working class, poor people, and what I call surplus humanity. So that's one thing that I'm referring to when I say global police state. The second is, and this is really important, how the global economy is itself becoming more and more based on the development and deployment of these systems of warfare, of social control and repression, simply as a means of making profit and continuing to accumulate capital in the face of this ongoing stagnation. This is what I call militarized accumulation or accumulation by repression. You carry out wars, you carry out repression, you implement systems of social control, surveillance, and systems of mass incarceration, building walls along the border, deportation regimes, refugee control systems. All of this now becomes a way of making profit independent of the political considerations. And the third thing I mean by a global police state is that we're moving increasingly towards political systems, of course in the United States, but in many countries around the world, that we can characterize as 21st century fascism. And I'll just elaborate in a moment on what I mean by that. But let me go back, because the story starts here with the crisis, the global economic crisis. You mentioned the failing U.S. economy, and it's, again, part of the failing global economy. This is a big structural crisis. As you and your listeners know, the spokespeople, the mainstream economists, the neoliberal economists, government spokespeople, and international agencies like the International Monetary Fund are saying that we're now in a recovery, the crisis is over, and so forth. But nothing could be further than the truth. The structural conditions that led to the 2008 collapse are still all in place. They've not been resolved. And in fact, from 2008 to 2018, they have gotten worse. You mentioned in the introduction inequality. Well, we're all familiar now with this data that has been put forth by the Oxfam Development Agency. In 2016, 1% of humanity, and this is worldwide, had over 50% of the world's wealth. But equally as important or more important, the next 95% of humanity had, the next 20% of humanity combined with the 1% had 95% of the world's wealth. What does that mean? 80% of humanity, the vast majority of the world's population, has only 5% of the world's wealth. So we have never seen such unbelievable levels of inequality. Now, of course, it's in the nature of the capitalist system to create this inequality unless states intervene, unless mass movements and unions intervene to offset that, to change that inequality. And what that means is that the system cannot unload, the global market cannot absorb the global output. So there's this incredible stagnation. Corporations are awash in cash. We have seen from 2008 to 2018, remarkably, corporate profits have surged, and corporations have more profit-making, but and sitting on more piles of cash than ever before. But they cannot profitably invest that cash because 80% of humanity cannot consume because of this inequality. And increasingly, even that 20%, or sections of that 20%, are slipping down and cannot consume. So what has been the way that the global economy has continued from 2008 into 2018? Well, we know that one mechanism is what the economists call quantitative easing. Basically, the U.S. government, but other governments as well, print money and simply throw that money into circulation. So momentarily, the economy doesn't collapse. It keeps going. Another thing going on now is unbelievable levels of what we can call debt-driven consumption, meaning that, for instance, in the United States, workers have now $14 trillions of dollars in debt, in student loan debt, in credit card debt, so they can continue to consume momentarily, but it's reaching the breaking point. They're going to go into default. And when they stop consuming, the economic crisis comes because capitalists can't sell their goods and the system collapses. The other thing, and this data is absolutely remarkable, that has kept the global economy going from 2008 to 2018 is unbelievable levels of financial speculation. In fact, last time I was on your program, I had mentioned this data because I came up with it in last year, in 2017, through my research, that the global economy produces $75 trillion worth of goods and services every year. However, just the trading in global derivatives. Let's remember that derivatives is pure financial speculation. It's not connected to the real production of goods and services. In that same year was $1.2 quadrillion. So there's these unbelievable levels of speculation, just unheard of. Our mind can't even wrap around it. And it has temporarily allowed the global economy to continue without collapsing between 2008 and 2018. But all of this means that those structural conditions are going to implode. And we're headed towards a giant, big crisis, whether it comes out this year, next year, the year after, we can't predict, but it is coming. So that leaves the key question. How do the global corporations, the rich and the investor class, how do they keep on unloading the surplus and accumulated, all of the surplus wealth accumulated, and continue to make profits? And here, this is where global police state comes in. There's two mechanisms that they have to do that. One of these is they have been massively investing in the what is now the overinflated tech sector. Because the reason I'm raising this is because the tech sector is fusing with global police state and it's making global police state possible. So look at this data. In 1970, corporations, finance, the banks and so forth, investors invested $17 billion in the tech sector. That was back in 1970, of course, before the mass use of the Internet. Fast forward to the 1990s, they invested $175 billion. Fast forward to 2000, they invested $500 billion annually. This is annually. And then in 2017, their investments surpassed $700 billion. So you have this vast pouring of resources into this overinflated tech sector. That's one thing that has taken place to try and unload all of this accumulated wealth. The second big thing is that they have hedged their bets on an expansion of global police state, investing in global police state. Again, what I said at the introduction is this is what I call militarized accumulation or accumulation by repression. So then the idea of a global police state is that for the system, for the ruling groups, it achieves two things. First, it allows for social control and for repression of rebellious populations. It keeps a lid on things. And secondly, independent of that, it is staving off economic crisis in the face of stagnation, in the face of those structural issues I was mentioning. So it is no surprise that the Pentagon's budget has increased by 91% between 1998 and 2011. Then under Obama, it continued to increase, but now it's taking a further jumped forward under Trump. The Trump government, well, with the support of Democrats and Republicans, increased it by $80 billion. And it should be no surprise then that defense industry profits have quadrupled since 2001. Quadrupled, 400% increase. So we see here how investing in global police state offsets this tendency towards the structural crisis and towards collapse. Now, I want to step back and repeat that point that the system needs a global police state to contain the real and the potential rebellion of masses of people in the United States and worldwide, what we can call the global poor and the global working class and surplus humanity. And I've mentioned how inequality is escalating here. But this is now linked to the issue of digitalization because all of this comes together. We already know, and many people have talked about this, this is not an original statement, but let's remember that digitalization is aggravating and will continue to deeply aggravate an extension of mass underemployment and unemployment and generate more and more surplus humanity thrown out of the economy, replaced by advanced technologies. And those that still have jobs face flexibilized jobs, precarious jobs, temporary jobs, part-time job. So digitalization is affecting every sector of the global economy. And we're seeing a digital decimation of the global economy. Now, I have a fantastic quote I want to read you here because the ruling groups are aware of this unbelievable inequality. They're aware of this coming rebellion, and they're getting very scared. So last year, the CEO of Cartier, if your listeners don't know, is an upscale jewelry company. The CEO is Johann Rupert. He's a multi-billionaire. I think he's worth $8 or $9 billion. He commented to a reporter last year that he said, every night I'm having nightmares because I believe that any moment the poor people in the world are going to rise up and overthrow us. And here is another quote. I was just reading an interview done by of Rana Forhorar. She's the financial correspondent for the Financial Times in London, and she's also frequently on CNN, of all things of this mainstream media. And this is what she said. Listen to this quote. I've asked people who have ridiculous amounts of money, why are you still trying to make more money? And it comes down to, because that's who I am. What else am I going to do? So I ask myself, how do these people go home at night and not be concerned about climate crisis, about war, about financial meltdown? How do they not worry about that? One thing I've been hearing from a lot of wealthy people, she says, to continue the quote, since the election of Trump, actually, is that they have escape plans. You know, I mean, there was this very interesting story, actually, in The New Yorker by Evans Osno. And when I knew, actually, when he was a reporter in China, and he covered the ways in which rich people are buying up ranches in New Zealand and creating bunkers in the Bahamas or wherever they're going, thinking that they're somehow going to be able to avoid the apocalypse when it comes. There's actually a business that operates in New York. It's a boat that will come. You can apparently pre-buy the tickets. You can pre-buy them. And if there's some political crisis or some danger moment, they come and pick you up and whisk you up the Hudson. So even the global ruling class and the rich and the elite know what is going down here. So to conclude this, you know, this introductory overview of what I'm suggesting with global police state, what we are seeing is that there is now a fusion of the tech sector that I've already spoken about with the financial sector. Some people are calling that fintech. Right, the fusion into one single thing. So the fate of Silicon Valley and the fate of Wall Street is now tied up with global police state, with the deep state, with the military, with all of these repressive apparatuses. And I want to mention on that regard one other thing, and that is that Google now is fully Google, but also Amazon, all of them. I misplaced the article in front of me with the actual piece of data, unfortunately, but Google is now fully integrated with the Pentagon and with police forces. in the United States, but also worldwide. They supply the technology, they supply the know-how, they make billions of dollars in profits in doing so. So just to conclude a couple points, digitalization, therefore, is making possible the global police state. And the new fourth industrial revolution technologies that including artificial intelligence, bio and nano technology, the Internet of Things, autonomous vehicle, autonomous drones, all of the new technologies made possible by digitalization and coming on stream right now are being applied to warfare and to repression. So we are moving towards a global war economy, and we are moving towards, I fear, 21st century fascism. And I'll conclude with the statement with this. We're moving towards a global society of the 1%, the 20%, and the 80%. I mentioned that previously, citing the Oxfam report on global inequality. But what that means is that the world's space, not space in the sky, but the actual territory in the Earth, is being divided into three giant zones. One is what we know as the green zones, because when the U.S. invaded and legally invaded and occupied Iraq, they set up a green zone right in the center of Baghdad, and that's where the U.S. was, the U.S. Political representatives and military officers, but also the new Iraqi elite brought to power by the invasion were in this green zone. There was an impenetrable barrier around it. No one could get in and out. Meanwhile, the mass of the Iraqis suffered this unbelievable nightmare and chaos outside of the green zone. So we're seeing worldwide the green zoning of the world. The rich, the more comfortable, the professionals, trader, the better off, live in green zones in the megacities around the world where they're protected by policing. Global police state protects them. They have privatized social services. They can communicate with one another through the Internet, etc. Meanwhile, we have hot wars all around the world. We have Yemen. We have Syria. We have what's going on in Honduras, you mentioned, and so forth. But in between, we have what's called the gray zone. Not the green zone, but the gray zones, and that's increasingly a majority of humanity through the militarization of cities and of countrysides in the United States and all around the world, and that's where global police state is being applied, to militarize cities, militarize civil society. So I'll just conclude by saying the final thing, because I don't want, and the final thing on this comment, I don't want listeners to be depressed. We do have to remember one thing also, that global police state is also a reaction. It's a reaction to all of the resistance we've seen in the last few decades all around the world, and it's a reaction to the crisis of the system's legitimacy, of its hegemony. So in some sense, it's reactive, right? So I'll stop there for the moment, but that in a nutshell is how I'm thinking about global police states.
Okay, I appreciate your overview and your insights. I'm going to ask you to address the following issues, if you would, please. One is the Internet providers, such as Facebook and Google, who are censoring people that, like, for example, John Pilger, one of the greatest journalists in English history and Australian history. Julian Assange is being censored. They're blocking his Internet access. In the United States, Chris Hedges, Cornel West, at least 300 people who would be considered progressives, they're all being censored in different ways. How does that play into this global police state censorship of people, including the surveillance of people who are anti-war, making it a crime to criticize anything that Israel does to the Palestinians? That's now a law in South Carolina, but also other countries like Great Britain. If you criticize Israel, you could go to jail. Also, people who are environmentalist, making environmentalism the same as a domestic terrorist in the eyes of the FBI and Homeland Security. In fact, this was actually shown in Freedom of Information Act documents from Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, that every single protest in the United States by Occupy Wall Street had infiltrators, provocateurs from the FBI and other intelligence agencies collecting all the data they could on every single protester. So where is our freedom of speech if that speech could be construed, no matter how innocuous, by those in power as a threat to them? Separately, right. Separate issue.
Mm-hmm.
separate issue. Let me get all my issues out, then you can take your time and answer them.
Mm-hmm.
We have misconstrued the value of Wall Street. I did an analysis, a very detailed and scholarly analysis, and I came up with the fact that we have 10 million millionaires in the United States. That means they have $1 million minus their real estate. We have 17.2 million professional class, lawyers, doctors, engineers, professors, CPAs, architects, people who have an advanced education, who are careerists. And with when you add in four people per family, it's about 112 million people. But let's round it off saying 100 million people. So we have 100 million people who have extreme power economically. 40 million of those, the sons and daughters and spouse of the millionaires, they can buy pretty much anything they want. They don't have to have debt to do it. If their kid wants to go to New York University at $67,000 a year tuition, they can easily afford that. Plus, they can buy them a co-op or apartment. Now, a lawyer or an engineer or CPA, their son and daughter could also go to Harvard or Yale or one of the Ivy League schools, pay a lot of money, but they're going to borrow money in order to do that. So they're heavily in debt. How do I know that? Because a friend of mine is one of the foremost financial advisors in the United States. To get to him to advise you, he does not invest anyone's money. He merely gives you advice on investing your money. You have to have about $5 million to get his attention. And now he's telling me that virtually every single client he has is asking him to help them become more liquid. And when he says you've made investments in things that don't earn money but actually lose money, they're shocked. You mean that designer car and the yacht and all these other things I bought are not worth what I paid for them? He said, no. Buy a diamond, you're paying excessive retail. Go to sell it, you're below cost. There could be a huge spread. So people who once thought they had wealth because they thought, well, I bought all these items, they must be worth something. Outside of real estate, it's not true. So we have an enormous debt bubble. You referred to the larger $14 trillion debt bubble, but we frequently don't include people in these debt bubbles that are professionals, because they make more money than the rest of the population. But indeed, we are closer to having insolvency in people than at any time in my lifetime. Then you have another factor that living on debt, and that Wall Street doesn't earn money for the rest of the population. Its profits are not shared. There was a time in America where in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, where a dollar would exchange hands about 67 times in local economy. You'd go to buy, as a professor, you go to buy a loaf of bread. The person who owned the bakery would go and put clothes in the dry cleaners. Dry cleaners go to a movie. The movie would go to a deli, and so it went. Today, with everything being digital, it's only about 6 times, not 67 times. So the amount of cash that people have on hand is extremely limited. In fact, the latest report just today, 150 million Americans, 150, have less than 2 weeks of cash on hand. So if they were out of work for more than 2 weeks, they could not pay their bills. And we're not talking about a few people. We're talking about 150 million people. There is no effort to help those people. There is no effort to de-ghettoize American or European cities. And by the way, the very same thing is happening in Europe. The European Central Bank bailed out corporations and banks. They did not bail out individuals. Greece is a good example of that. But right behind Greece, you also have Italy and Spain and most of the 27 European nations, member nations, are in debt, some more so than others. And yet nothing is being done to change that. On top of all this, you have three things that nobody counts when they're talking about the economy. They're not talking about the weather and the fact that extreme weather events, 122,000 last year in the world. Just think, I live in Florida on a ranch, and we had a Category 5, a 4, the worst in the state's history, and it impacted over 7 million Floridians, and most of those people are not going to have insurance cover anything, and it just wipes you out. Then you have health insurance that does not cover most people's illnesses. So we're getting sicker with more obesity, more diabetes, more cancer, more heart disease, more Alzheimer's and dementia than ever before in our history. And we don't have the money to pay for these bills. We're unhealthy. We're broke. And then we have weather conditions that we're not insured for when we end up getting some catastrophic event. So when you look at our weather, global warming, when you look at our health, the national health of people, when you look at, in Africa, you have all these migrants, 160 million people in Africa are now environmental migrants. They can't live where they used to because there's no way of having water or food that is sustainable. We're only looking at the political migrants going to Europe because of our intervention and Europe's in Libya and Syria and Niger. And we're not looking at the reality of what happens. So I'm seeing a really serious problem with global warming and its consequences, debt, where people are paying for their food or medicines or rent or mortgage with credit cards. And no one's looking at how broke most Americans are. We're only looking at those who have super amounts of wealth. And there's not a single thing being done to de-ghettoize American cities, European cities, to raise the minimum wage to a living wage. And yet there's 96 million Americans who once worked, could work, and are not working, and they're excluded from the official unemployment figure 3.9%, because when you factor in how many people actually are unemployed, it's 24%. So we're not even honest. Not the economists are honest. The media is not honest. The government's not honest about how many people are actually unemployed, underemployed, how many people are in debt, and what we're not doing to help any of this. It all goes to the military-industrial complex or special interest. Would you address these issues, please?
Yes. I mean, these are, you know, issues that go to the heart of our contemporary U.S. and world reality, and related to what we were previously discussing. Let me start with the first issue about Facebook and Google and the giant internet companies increasingly censoring us and what we know or don't know about the world. And, I mean, of course, the sociological point here is that this is a way of controlling human conduct, human behavior. What we do in the world is based on what we know about the world. And so if the powers that be can control what we know about the world, what our perceptions of the world are, where danger is coming from, where it's not coming from, what's happening and what's not happening, they control our behavior. So this part is not new, but that was previously played by the print media. You know, the print and television media still play a major role with regard to complete corporate control of that traditional media and the information we get and don't get about the world and who's censored and not censored. So it's a form of mass social control and hegemony, the control of the traditional corporate media. That we know. But here's what happened. Internet came online massively in the 1990s, really took off in the 21st century. And so social media opened up a space that broke that monopoly of our understanding of the world through the traditional corporate media. And, you know, social media is responsible for mass mobilizations from below and social movements and even some revolutions and so forth. And so that became a problem for the power structure, that social media gets around the control of the traditional corporate media, which, again, is print media and television and radio. And that is part of the story of why there's this this attack against a free and available internet. In part, it's simply for profit, right? That how do you turn into profit-making the internet? But in the other part of that is that you have to snuff out the ability of social media and the internet sites such as Facebook and Google and so forth to be a forum for alternative understandings of the world and for information that's not getting out by state, by governments, and not getting out mainly by the traditional corporate media. So that's really what's behind what we see, an intensification of this censorship and this control over information at the level of the big internet companies, Google and Facebook and so forth. And, of course, I don't have to tell your listeners that this is exactly how Big Brother works in the famous novel 1984. We've come beyond that these days. So this is what also, by the way, Pentagon planners refer to as perception management. These are basically, you know, in some ways, this is taking it a step further. These are psychological operations, but the Pentagon refers to perception management as how do you control the perception of masses of people, of the general public? Because if you control their perception, you control their behavior. So I think that's really a front line in the struggle here is what's going on with the control of information and censorship at the level of social media and the tech companies. And by the way, just in parentheses, before I move on to the other very important issue you were raising about debt and so forth, I did find that quote, and here is the quote. A new book just came out, Surveillance Valley, The Secret Military History of the Internet. I just got it, and so it's intimately related to that point you were raising. And this is just one little quote from that book showing how the internet companies, Google, Facebook, and all of them have fused with global police state. And he says, over the years, Google supplied mapping technology used by the U.S. Army in Iraq, hosted data for the Central Intelligence Agency, indexed the National Security Agency's vast intelligence databases, built military robots, co-launched a spy satellite with the Pentagon, and leased its cloud computing platform to help police departments predict and crime. And Google is not alone. From Amazon to eBay to Facebook, some parts of these companies are so thoroughly intertwined with America's security services that it's hard to tell where they end and where the U.S. government begins. So that's that quote I wanted to read, and it's just totally related to the point you're raising about Facebook and Google and the internet providers. With regard to the second point, the quite traumatic figures you had there, that there are maybe 100 million that are in that class of people in the United States that can actually consume and participate, while the rest are, that would be 230 million more, just sinking downward, becoming increasingly surplus, throwaway humanity. But that in turn is linked to what I was pointing out, that the only way you can have this 100 million rather than 2 or 3 or 4 million is because of this ever-growing gap between a speculative economy and the real economy, which is that data I was putting out previously. The 75 trillion is the global real economy, and 1.2 quadrillion is just derivative speculation. That's what we call more, you know, in political economy and sociology, which use a technical term, financialization of global capitalism. And that's really what you're getting at there. And the figure that you gave, again, all of this points to a looming crisis, which will be massive, and then it's going to lead to social, political crisis and wars of unpredictable outcomes. But you said that 150 million people have actual cash that will last them less than 2 weeks. So if they go get out of a job, within 2 weeks they have to declare default on student loans, on credit card debt, on their mortgages, and so forth. So that means if a recession hits, or worse than a recession, a bigger crisis hits, the system is going to go tumbling down in free fall. And here's the thing, though. So you're saying, the system is not doing anything whatsoever about this. Well, what we need to turn some of this around, and I'm just going to put the climate side on hold for a moment in my response. I mean, that's massive. The climate side is something that simply makes global capitalism will lead to our extinction if we don't resolve it, address it. But just putting that aside, at the level of the political economy, the actual global economy, we need redistribution downward. We desperately need a redistribution of wealth downward. But it's not to the Wall Street investor class, it's not to what I call the transnational capitalist class, that we're going to get that redistribution downward. Capital has only one objective, to massively and never-endingly accumulate as much profit as possible. And that's pushing us into the situation that you laid out. And it's pushing us into global police state, as we've analyzed. So the key issue is capital's not going to do that. Profit trumps everything. Is how do we bring about a redistribution downward, and how do we bring about a re-regulation of the U.S. and the global economy? Because without that, we cannot address the issue that you're pointing out. And where is that going to come from? Well, on the one hand, we have an interesting development. Increasingly, members of the transnational elite that are reformist-oriented. They're thinking, well, we have to save the system from itself, are calling for such a redistribution and such a re-regulation of the U.S. and the global economy. But they are a minority voice. And under Trump and where things are going now, they're even more and more drowned out, those voices of reform among the transnational, U.S. and transnational elite. So the only thing that's going to force a redistribution is mass pressure from below that doesn't give the system any option but to bring about reform. Quite radical reform, redistributive reform, regulatory reform. I mean, of course, I'd like to see the system overthrown. I'm a socialist, but that's besides the point. What we need to resolve this situation you're referring to is a massive redistribution and massive re-regulation of the economy. And that's only going to come about through mass mobilizations from below. Now, when this crisis breaks out, again, it could be a recession in 2018, but the bigger one in 2020, you can't actually predict it, that these types of crises always lead to mass upheavals, to social and political conflicts. And maybe that crisis will spur enough of a mobilization from below to restructure the system in a reformist way. But my biggest fear, Gary, is that the other thing that's gotten the system out of these types of crises is global war. And what brought the system out of the 1930s depression was World War II. And I think that's why you have these mounting international tensions, the threat of a new war in the Middle East with Iraq, the threat of war on the border, you know, the western flanks of Russia, the threat of war with North Korea, who knows what's going to happen there. All around the world, we have these built increasing international tensions, and part of underlying that is that war saves the system from economic collapse, and then it also allows people to be repressed. And of course, with the mass media being controlled and Facebook and Google, it whips up nationalist sentiment and takes people's attention away from the real problems of the system.
Thank you for that deep insight. Let us now focus upon an institution that is rarely, if ever, discussed. I haven't seen an article on it in years, and that is the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, and what their objective was and what the consequences to other countries that borrowed money became, and how the giving that money never to the people, never to anything in any country I could find that helps the people, but generally those in power and to private interest groups connected to that kind of insiders group, the deep state companies. What happens to a country that accepts money from the World Bank, International Monetary Fund, and then goes into debt, and how it's exploited? Could you address that too?
Absolutely. Well, the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund were, they still are, but they were, if we take the story back to the 1980s, they were absolutely key instruments of the global banks, of the transnational capitalist class, and of the states, the governments of the rich countries, for opening up the whole world to transnational corporate plunder and for promoting the neoliberal agenda, free trade, austerity for the masses, lifting any restrictions on corporate investment and profit-making, environmental regulations. Basically, what we used to call the Third World, the Global South, went deeply into debt in the 1970s, 1980s. They had to turn to the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund to bail them out, and then the loans were made with very strict conditions. You open up your economy to corporations, you deregulate, you privatize everything, you impose austerity on the masses. So that story has been going on since the 1980s, and it hasn't really changed at all. So we went into this new globalized production and financial and service system, in part through this mechanism of World Bank and IMF intervention, loan conditionality. It used to be called structural adjustment programs. Okay, that we know. But what's going on now is that since 2008, and from 2008 to 2018, the traditional global South, I'm talking about, of course, obviously Africa, Asia, Latin America, the Middle East, and so forth, they suffered tremendously under that crisis of 2008, but also commodity prices were very high. There was a spike worldwide in commodity prices from 2008 to 2014 and 2015. So the IMF and the World Bank did not do a lot of lending in that period. Of course, they did to Greece, and Greece is a textbook case of what you're talking about, right? lend to Greece in order for Greece to simply pay back to the IMF, the World Bank, and the European and global investors with zero going to the population, privatize everything in Greece, throw the country into third world status, et cetera. But the rest of the global south didn't have much lending done from the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund in this period. But now global commodities prices tumbled in 2014 and on. Oil has picked up, but oil went from like $120 a barrel down to $36, $37 a barrel, and all of the commodities tumbled. And so a lot of the countries in the global south are having to turn once again to the IMF and the World Bank. The example that's most prominent right now is Argentina. You remember that Argentina defaulted the IMF, the World Bank, and to the private banks, because the IMF and World Bank work with the, and represent the interests of the private banks. So they declared a moratorium on the debt in 2001. The government went to the left, turned to the left as part of the whole turn to the left in Latin America in the, from 2000 up until recently. And now the right wing has come back in power throughout Latin America, including in Argentina. Macri is the president in Argentina, has just signed a new agreement with the International Monetary Fund, and that's sparking mass rebellion in Argentina. So they are back on the scene in the face of this global of the global downturn and the coming crisis. But one other point I want to make is another thing that the World Bank does, not the International Monetary Fund, but the World Bank, and that is that they provide funding to governments for this infrastructural projects, which would open up a country to the corporate plunder. And the example I want to give is Honduras, because here it's linked to our earlier discussion on global police states. In Honduras, this is just one example of many, but in Honduras, the World Bank lent several billion dollars to build a giant dam. Sarca something dam. And that dam is being constructed in the middle of indigenous and poor peasants and farmer territory in Honduras. And so there have been unbelievable mass protests. Many of the listeners will be familiar with some of this. It included and the massive repression of those protests. And one of the people assassinated by the state security forces with the backing of the United States in those protests was Berta Cáceres. Berta Cáceres won international awards as an environmental and an indigenous activist and leader of these protests against the dam. Why were they building the dam? Not to give electricity to poor people or water to poor people, but because they needed that electricity to give to the maquiladoras, the sweatshops, which are dominating the Honduran economy, and the transnational corporate, transnational tourist facilities, which are for rich people that go to Honduras and enjoy them while the poor people are displaced. So that dam was financed by the World Bank, led to the assassination of Berta Cáceres and this ongoing repression. How this ties to global police state is, your listeners might remember that in November of 2017, just last year, there were elections. They were won by the opposition, the Alliance Against the Dictatorship, and yet massive fraud and repression kept the current dictatorial government in power through that fraud. The United States instantly recognized the new government, ignored the fraud, and it's that government which is now imposing massive global police state conditions on the population as protest has escalated. So all of this comes together. That is to say, then, just to summarize, that the World Bank and the IMF are not just tinkering with the global economy to defend the interests of corporate capital, but they're also linked directly and indirectly to the issue of global police states.
Okay, final question for you. Could you address the fact that America now has unsafe drinking water in most of its communities? In fact, over 250 million Americans. I'm not asking you to specifically address the issue of water, but the fact mm-hmm. that local governments, state governments are not caring for their citizens. You mentioned green zones, where if you're wealthy enough, you can go into a community and therefore be protected. You'll have quality of life. But what about all the people who can't get into those? We're not doing anything to reverse the ghettoization of our schools, of our health care, and of our living conditions. Could you address the ghettoization of America and then having prisons that the private prisons that now have gone back to reinstitute what was banned in Constitution or the Supreme Court upheld that ban on being put into prison because you were too poor to pay a bill, debtors' prisons. Debtors' prisons are back, and they're not the the professional class nor the millionaires nor the billionaires are going into these prisons, but poor people are.
Yes. Well, I mean, all of this again links together. Let's just focus for a moment on the issue, remember I was talking earlier about how the whole global economy is being restructured through digitalization, and part of that restructuring means that there's this ever-increasing rise in the surplus population, meaning people cannot even fit into the global economy in a way in which they can survive. And so the system does not have much use for the surplus population, right? The ghettoized population, the underemployed, and the massively unemployed. And this goes for the United States, but of course worldwide. So how do you achieve two things with this surplus population? Well, one, you have to control them and contain them. So that's what we've been discussing: global police state, and of course prisons. But secondly, you have to somehow take that surplus population and turn them into a source of profit making. And they're not going to be profit making by giving them good jobs. So you turn them into profit making by having private prisons and private immigrant detention centers, especially the immigrant detention centers. It's nearly 100% private, whereas still there's some public prisons. And then you, of course, use them as slave labor. So, I mean, I think that And that's going on worldwide. I don't have the quote in front of me, but I just assigned my students a book which goes through the new slavery reappearing all around the world, slavery that disappeared in earlier centuries. So, again, also going back to debtor's prison, that's the problem, is that in the United States, I mentioned there's $13 trillion in debt, but that doesn't include the mortgage debt. That's just credit card debt, student loan, immediate consumer debt. And then the mortgage debt is, of course, trillions and trillions of dollars. So if a collapse comes, or the banks, the financial tech merger, loses all of that money. So you need some mechanism in place, which is debt peonage and debt prison, which, you know, just disappeared two centuries ago, to guarantee that you have the population locked into repaying. But that's a contradiction. The population can't. So the unsafe drinking water, of course, you hit the nail on the head. Why do the ruling groups, absent any other forms of pressure, why do they need to worry about unsafe drinking water for that 80% for our ghettoized cities, when the 20% affluent, or the 100 million that you mentioned, can simply get filtered water and bottled water and so forth? So, I mean, I think you're pointing, by pointing to the issue of the drinking water and prison labor and so forth, you're pointing to the most ugliest dimensions of this new face of global capitalism, but also of the crisis of global capitalism. And I don't want to ever leave the listeners with the depressed notion that we should just throw down our hands and there's nothing we can do about it, which is why I'd like to also just reiterate once more that we see all around the world, even though sometimes we don't get the information, it's controlled by Facebook and Google, but we see massive resistance everywhere. Some of this, of course, is far-right, confused far-right resistance, neo-fascist resistance, but much of this resistance is, there is a global rebellion underway, and that's where we need to pin our hopes. I mean, of course, in the United States, the teachers are now striking in one state after another, and remarkably, as your listeners know, they're not just calling for increase in their own salary, but for a refunding of public education and so forth. So resistance is underway, and there is a groundswell from below, and that's where the hope lies here. And maybe that resistance will give the upper hand also to the reformist elements among the transnational elite. Not that they're going to save us, but they could get on board. So, you know, that's some of my thoughts on what you're raising.
You've helped us better understand our problems and what we're facing. You can't change anything if you don't know the depth and context of the problems, and you've laid it out very nicely for us. Thank you very much, Professor William Robinson, Professor of Sociology at the University of California at Santa Barbara, and author of a very important work, Global Capitalism, the Crisis of Humanity. I appreciate you.
Thank you very much, Gary. It's always a pleasure to be on your program.
I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you. cry. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you die. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love. Don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Picket lines and picket signs. Punish me, sister, with brutality, sister. Talk to me, sister, so you can see.